first of all, without talking to anyone else, and just jot down what you think happiness is. What's your concept of that? When you've made a note of your opinion, try out your next door neighbour, see whether you agree with each other, if not whether you want to revise your own private view. If you don't have someone sitting next to you, you need to turn around or move. Okie dokie. Let's hear a bit. So you're in the back row. Any opinions from the back row? What would you say happiness is? Friends and family. Someone down the front. Fulfillment. You'll do. Sorry? Indeed.
A good self-esteem.
I'm neglecting the left wing for my position. what did you think? Praising things positively. So spin doctors will make you happy, unlike these traditional people. Yes. Did you have a different opinion or...? Okay. And behind you?
Pleasurable.
And the row behind? The absence of negative things, yes. Back row. There you go, a Maslow disciple. My office is next to Margaret Martin, she'll say stuff like this, but what do you mean by self-actualized? I've never understood the expression. even though I know you're required to repeat it. But okay, so no big aspirations unless you're sure you can attain them then. I clearly didn't altogether ask the question I meant to, but still, those are good starting points. During the course of this afternoon, I'll say a bit more, but here's just a opening suggestion. I mean, if you say to someone when you're relaxing in the evening what makes you happy, you're likely to mention things that are pleasurable first. I think another everyday concept that isn't quite the same is about joy, say. So in those areas of the emotion literature which try and make out there are only seven emotions, joy will typically be one of them. But depending on your theory of emotion, of course, but one angle on emotion is that they're emotions in the most basic sense are responses to events, so they're transient reactions. And joy then, I take it, is the reaction to an unexpectedly good event, which is why you see so much of it in sports, since many sports are deliberately arranged so no one could be sure about the outcome. And that's why you see these great expressions of either, you know, disappointment and dejection or joy there. On the other hand, I think the word happiness seems to imply in everyday language a state that's going to last a bit longer than a sudden event. But the word that's perhaps most useful for you to think about in this course is probably tends to be well-being, and I think part of that is because well-being doesn't imply that the person is necessarily consciously and vividly aware of it, in which case some of the things that got mentioned about having self-efficacy, self-esteem, not being burdened by intrusive worries would perhaps be aspects of that. And I raise it because I think a popular view of happiness is that you're going to be vividly aware of it, but I suspect for many of you the things that you're more likely to be thinking about after this course, and if you go into a professional area related to this course, it's probably going to be about well-being, and it's less about what people report from moment to moment and more about an underlying idea of health. And I'll say more about that in an hour or so. Where did all the spare handouts end up? Have you got them? Right, yeah. There's what two kinds. You want one of each. Each of you wants one of each. Okay, so I'm going to spend the next chunk of time introducing you to a standard and topic in positive psychology, which is about gratitude. There's been several studies. This is one of them. So, the exercise of counting your blessings is periodically, it might be once a week, spend a few minutes to write down things that you feel grateful for. And the three conditions would be writing down things you're grateful for, writing down hassles, things that aren't going well, or writing down things that may not have a particular emotional valence about events or circumstances. And this used 200 undergraduates. it didn't show an immediately it didn't show a comparative score, at least not a significant one, on their mood, but it did on things like expectations or their evaluation of their life as a whole. But most interestingly is they reported fewer physical symptoms. In fact, in one of these studies, they looked at how often students in each of the groups went to visit the medical services on campus. And some of these gratitude studies showed a significant difference in that. So that's tapping into well-being, not necessarily well-being at the top of your mind, but perhaps lower down, but more importantly. And this is just about taking a few minutes periodically to, in some sense, reflect on positive things in your life. This one affected positive emotion, positive affect, rather than the other things. And that was once a day. Now, third study with people with serious and disabling condition, and it affected their scores on affect and also on sleep, but not on other health measures. So a variety of effects from that. Now, a study that seems to me in the same general area is not so much counting your blessings or listing things that are good in your life as writing about a single positive experience. So this was, you do it for 3 days running and you write for 20 minutes about one versus spending the same amount of time describing your shoes or your plans. That certainly got to positive mood, fewer health centre visits. So, and there's quite a number of other studies. They vary in the details, but there are a lot of studies that manage to show significant effects in that way. So, spend a minute or two thinking about, do you spend any time reviewing good things in your life? Or like a proper goal-driven person, professional person of today, do you just spend time reviewing things that are going wrong and how you're going to fix them, or who you're going to complain to if you're more of a whiny person? So do you spend time actually reflecting on good things? Then have a little think and then discuss it with your next door neighbour. Okay, you've had a few minutes to think about that. Now, is anyone able to say, yes, they definitely do fairly regularly spend time reflecting on positive things? One, two, you have to get your hands above your head as a signal, not stick them between your legs. Yeah. So quite a few, and there are people who are pretty sure they virtually never do that. Okay. For those who never do that, do you spend time reflecting on bad things? And is there any sense of gradually working through bad things? Yes, for one? Okay. The point of asking that is that if you just want to think about positive psychology, it seems natural that you should be focusing on exercises that look at the positive. But if you review these gratitude articles and then ask who else has done writing exercises, actually there's quite a long literature on this, and it looks as if you get rather similar effects when getting people to write about bad things. And this is a very interesting critique. This is the kind of thing to think about in positive psychology, about whether the perspective a bit of research offers you is necessarily the only one. So in writing, there's certainly aspects, you can certainly overdo it. So as you may already have come across, there's an area where, what do they call it, rumination. They use the word rumination to describe teenage girls who go on and on with their best friends about what's wrong in their life, and they just repeat the stuff, and it becomes a negative and destructive cycle. This actually isn't about repeating stuff, it's about writing to work through it. And I think it's interesting and probably important in positive psychology to bear that in mind, not least because other exercises, above all mindfulness, which is becoming so popular, is actually about working through both positive and negative and not letting yourself be stampeded by the immediate feelings. So maybe it's the process of working through that's the important one, and above all counteracting any natural imbalance depending on your temperament. Where's the sunlight coming from? It's probably that corner. Would someone like to wrestle with the curtains and see if they can... Of course this is, you know, maybe the only day this year that that will happen, but... Sorry, that's the problem. It's from these windows. They don't have windows over the fence, curtains over the fancy bits at the top. Sorry. Right. That. Oh dear. Oh dear. Right. The other point at the bottom of the slide, almost washed out by the sunlight, is it's possible that this isn't even about working through, it's about finding and creating meaning. So in the first discussion exercise, two or three people mentioned things which I would paraphrase as it's performing meaningful activities that make you happy in some sense. And that's been the theme in this area since Aristotle, about a meaningful life. So it's also possible that these writing exercises are helping people, I suppose nowadays some would say they're authoring a story about themselves and creating an identity, but it's about establishing a story about yourself and therefore establishing a meaning. Now, if you become a big fan of gratitude, then you can find quite a few formats for gratitude exercises. So. Looking for benefits, listing things to be grateful for, often called the Couch of Blessings exercise. Instead of a list, number three is the version where you pick just one, or at least one per day, and write about it at some length. Number four, though, is whether you write to someone else. So, it can certainly seem that it's good for the person giving thanks as well as those receiving thanks. And I think there's a couple of reasons why that can naturally get neglected in normal life. So the dramatic one that there's quite a few TV documentaries these days about is where someone, you know, drags you unconscious from a car wreck, and you're quite likely never to see them. You're unconscious when they fixed you. They slope off afterwards and you may never meet them again because the event was overwhelming. But another kind of case would be if, say, your parents died when you were young, you were brought up by your grandmother, you might come on later, and the person who brings you up, there's no one moment when it's appropriate to say thank you, but you might reflect as an adult on what a transformative effect a given person had had on your life, and might decide to write them a letter. Now, I think that brings in another feature of gratitude, is the ordinary uses of the word originate in social situations. It's not actually a one-person thing, gratitude. Normally it's a two-person thing. And it's interesting to reflect on the benefits on both sides. Now, I say that because in a social situation, one of the things that saying thank you does is it lets the other person know not just that you're grateful, but it lets the other person know that their action was effective. Now, if someone drags you out of a car wreck, actually they know they saved your life and the ambulance men will have told you that. You don't really have to say thank you for that. But in most situations, it's much less obvious. And I think one of the reasons that so many people like interacting with pre-adolescent children is they haven't learned to lie very effectively, and certainly not to lie in a social situation. And the result is you see what their feeling is in their face. You give them a present and they look bored and you know it hasn't worked. You give them another present and their face lights up and you know you've scored. And, you know, an uncle doesn't automatically know how a child's going to receive that. And it's a great relief from adult life where being polite is more important than conveying the truth. But if you don't convey the truth, the other person can't get better at actually doing positive things. So one thing about gratitude in the sense of a two-person interaction is not only that it's probably good for the person giving thanks, but it's actually, there's also information there for the recipient. Now, Seligman in his textbook describes what he did in one of his classes, not for every student, but he arranged not just that there should be saying thank you to someone else, but that this should be done in front of a large audience, which is hyping up this. And in fact, that BBC programme at the top of the slide, The Gift, it was a programme arranged around people going to meet someone who did them a massive favour in the past and effectively saying thank you in front of a large TV audience. Now, I might also say that that's about co-constructing meaning. That is, that one way of establishing meaning isn't just that you do a little private philosophical analysis, as you would as an academic trying to produce a precise definition for a new technical word you're going to use, but instead to construct an agreed account of something. And that's particularly important in helping people where it's not on secure ground without both of you being involved. So on the one hand, saving the life of someone who just wants to be dead and will go off and kill themselves anyway next week, you just interfered, you nasty little person, is quite different from saving the life of someone who's deeply grateful to still be alive. But also, there are other things, but the point is that I think because so much of our everyday communication in language is actually about establishing a common ground, establishing shared meanings of particular words, which aren't quite the same as what they mean with other people, illustrates how meaning has to be constructed, and that probably the most important kind of context for creating meaning is a social or communicative one. So it would fit in with that. I think also in these more dramatic things of saving someone's life, it's also important because, not always, but quite often, someone who saved someone's life took some actually over-the-top risk themselves, and then afterwards they probably get cold feet about whether they should have threatened their family by being careless with their own life to save someone else's. And it probably makes a big difference to whether they feel guilty about doing it or not, depending on how much it seemed to matter to the other person. Because, as you know, an absolute classic of British newspaper items is dog falls in the river, man jumps in and drowns, policeman drowns trying to save the man, and the dog gets themselves out afterwards. And that just illustrates people often are very poor at assessing rational risk. Conversely, it's good to get some definite feedback about whether your moment of madness was actually perhaps not as completely ill-considered as it can seem when you get cold feet afterwards. So we could think about gratitude as having three distinct benefits. One on the donor, one that's mutual, and one on the recipient. Now, I'm just going to make, comes from a Maxi student of mine a year or two ago. I haven't quite organised this yet. I'll get a link to that if you want to follow it up. But the point is, Leah did a very interesting study. She recruited people who self-report that they have high religiosity or spirituality, and she ran one of the classic gratitude exercises on them and showed no effect. Now, the technical flaw is she didn't have a control group which were for people with low religiosity, but it's clear from the literature that these effects, these manipulations are usually pretty reliable, and that in a randomly chosen group from the population at large, these gratitude exercises will work. And the fact that they didn't in people who were highly religious could be taken as to illustrate the idea that since, relatively speaking, the collapse of religion in, say, this country and quite a lot of others, perhaps we've lost things that religion used to provide, and that gratitude exercises are simply a replacement to get us back up to a level that people had anyway. Why do I say that? Because gratitude is, any of you who've attended any kind of Christian church service know, a large part of most of those services include thanksgiving. What's that? It's counting your blessings and acknowledging that your happiness and well-being depend on things outside yourself and agents outside yourself. And that's no longer part of most people's regular life. So it's possible to have this other view of positive psychology as a secular recapturing of things which have been built into organized and still are built into organized religion. Now, I don't know if that's true, but I think that's a very interesting critique to consider. It's also a good critique because it stops positive psychology claiming it's brand new and sounding tremendously self-satisfied and new. So one theme in this course is to think about every piece of positive psychology. You actually want to think about what its real history is. It will be presented as if it's new, but when you think about it, can you see it as just a new packaging for an old cultural practice? Another theme in this course is, for every bit of positive psychology you read about, it's good to try and think about, does, even though this doesn't say it has a relationship to other bits of positive psychology, is it in fact related? So just as those gratitude exercises in fact seem related to a longer tradition of writing exercises in general, so it also could be that gratitude is strongly connected to mindfulness. That it could be connected to what I'll talk about later this afternoon, Seligman's exercise to counteract pessimistic thinking or catastrophizing. That is, many people, I don't know that that's really true of everyone, but it's true of Seligman personally, and it's true of plenty of people, that the moment something happens, within milliseconds they think of the very worst possible interpretation. They don't think of the most likely, they don't think of the most optimistic, they just immediately flash to how a slight headache must mean a brain tumour, or the fact that your child's late back from school means they must have been killed in road accidents, as opposed to going to the shops and spending their money on sweets. You just leap to the worst interpretation. So you could think about gratitude as an attempt, perhaps in the same direction, to counteract that. You could think about it as writing a story for yourself about connecting to meaning, number four. And about ideas about positive and negative, and whether we should be organizing personal exercises along that axis. So, what can we say? There's respectable experimental results in controlled studies that show there are often real benefits, although the studies seem to vary on which measure shows up in which study. It's a solo self-help exercise. So another theme always to be thinking about in positive psychology is the intervention you're looking at essentially one that could be rolled out as private solo exercises? A lot of positive psychology is, especially in the early days, is in that self-help tradition. What can one person alone do to change things? But it's always good to ask the opposite. Is there a social form of the exercise? Gratitude, of course, has a natural social form, but more surprisingly, although mindfulness is almost always taught and almost always seen by outsiders as to do with a solitary practice where you go off alone, or if you're in a group, the group is entirely silent and non-interacting, but in fact, there's social versions apparently of mindfulness. I didn't know that till I got an expert in last year. So it's always interesting for any positive psychology theme to ask about the solo versus social dimension. Gratitude tends to be presented as a new practice, but actually equally it's an old religious practice. It also has a little bit of connection with 12-step approaches to recovering addicts, because if you read those 12 steps, some of them are to do with admitting that you're not in control of yourself, and being willing to admit you need help from outside, which of course many of us in this individualistic society are very, very reluctant to admit to ourselves about anything. It can also, just like many other positive psychology topics, it can have medical benefits. One or two of those studies showed medical benefits, and yet equally personal subjective happiness benefits. In fact, that's probably one of the biggest changes in perspective in the last 10 or 15 years, I think, is how, you know, 20 years ago, most people would probably have seen physical ailments as an entirely different thing from subjective happiness. And now there are more and more results about strong connections between the two. And so mindfulness has been used more and more around medicine in various ways. So that's another very good mental habit to get into, is to think about every exercise for whether it could have medical benefits, but also whether it could have happiness effects. We probably don't really understand what's underneath it, and it probably has some significant relationship to previous psychological theories. So part of what Seligman was doing in promoting the idea of the phrase of positive psychology and promoting the idea that it was a separate topic was to emphasize its difference from the rest of academic psychology. Now, obviously, that's politically useful, and it could be intellectually useful because it makes you think independently, but it almost certainly is only ever half right. So you'll probably notice almost every empirically sound piece of positive psychology could be, and many of them are, published in journals that don't have any particular connection to positive psychology. The other way of saying that is that these effects belong in other areas of psychology as much as they belong in positive psychology. So you want to try and develop both viewpoints. Right. I'll just spend a few minutes on this. It's a different topic. This is one of Seligman's. You'll find it some places like this. That's actually a better start to reference than Seligman himself. What is it? It's this is about combating what Seligman feels is a natural tendency to pessimism, that is, a natural tendency to see the worst in things. Can you train yourself to counteract that? So the title, which is perhaps an exaggeration, but is learned optimism. So so I'm just going to give before I mention the technique itself, give you some background ideas. When in most conversations or on the TV news someone asks why something happened, everyone unconsciously assumes there's a single reason, and that the job of the person answering the question is to provide the single reason back. And that's extremely common conversational practice. But it actually reflects a profound error from an analytic point of view. And that is that everything that happens doesn't have a single cause. Everything that happens has multiple causes, all of which have to be true. So just to give a very everyday example, suppose this was a glass. I've learned not to use glasses because they break all the time. Suppose it was. In my shambling about concentrating on the lecture, I knock it over and it crashes and breaks. What caused the glass to break? Well, and I use that because it's kind of about the simplest thing I could imagine as an example. But what are all the things that have to be true for the glass to break? Well, first of all, we have to be in a gravitational field. If they do that in a space station, it won't hit the ground for many minutes and it won't break. If the atmosphere you're in has to be not very dense, so if you're dressed up in scuba gear, sitting on the bottom of the on the seafloor, having it with glasses, and you drop a glass, it'll sink really slowly because the resistance of the water will prevent it falling hard enough. Glass has to be fragile and brittle. I didn't have any trouble with that rather ordinary plastic bottle. In fact, the floor covering matters a lot. If you have cushioned lino in your kitchen, you can probably get away with dropping wine glasses some of the time. And if you have concrete, you'll never get away with dropping a glass. So that's just four things, and we've just looked at the physical things. But Aristotle and everyone else would say, well, that glass wouldn't have fallen if I hadn't pushed it. That was my fault. Or if you had a more modern, sophisticated health and safety aspect, you would think about, were there factors that may be likely to be inattentive and clumsy here or not? So, for instance, because I am slightly clumsy, but I like to make coffee in a fragile glass thing, I've learnt to always keep it at the back of the bench next to the wall and not on the front, poorly balanced, and haven't had a breakage for a long time now. So, in other words, modern as opposed to traditional accident analysis, for instance, in the airline or the railway industries, are now very likely to be recommended safeguards. Nowadays, it's very unusual to have a rail or air accident that hasn't got at least three or four things going wrong. I mean, usually there has to be things to defeat the first and second and third lines of defences. They'll also be likely to recommend training changes, and so on. So each of those could be seen as a cause, and indeed are seen as a cause by serious analysts in various things. So first thing to get around is that an apparently everyday why question and its response about, yes, there's just one cause, is just, actually it's irrational. It's not a sound way of analysing things. Just as there are multiple causes, there are actually multiple effects. So if you ask what the effect of something is, it's you may be much more interested in one effect than another, but the objective fact in a thorough analysis will be about what the multiple effects are. So sometimes you can see in the jargon how twisted that is. So doctors like to call the effect of a drug they want the effect of the drug, and the effects of the drugs they don't want side effects, as if of clearly labelling their human wanty-wanty-wantiness right into the jargon, whereas to a real scientist, as opposed to the doctor, all those effects are equally effects, all part of what the drug does. It's not that it isn't good for practical purposes to focus on one cause over another, or one effect over another, but it's not a rational analysis. So, when something happens and you start making a tremendously pessimistic analysis, part of the background is, for any event, there are many analyses you might make, and jumping to the one that's most frightening to you isn't an objective thing to do. So this isn't about countering pessimism with a mindless optimism, it's about slowing down and realizing there are multiple alternatives, and your fear isn't the one that is going to lead you to the most sensible view of a of an event. So Seligman's learned optimism, or ABCDE exercise, is about reconsidering your attributions of effects and of future expectations. How familiar are you all with the fundamental attribution error? You've probably heard of it. You're able to instantly recall it to your mind, play with it. Fundamental attribution error is about, mostly about, whether you tend to attribute some effect to yourself, or, sorry, to the agent, or to the context. And the classic finding is that we tend to attribute other people's behaviour to them. It's their fault, it's because they're an inherently bad person. And we tend to attribute our actions to the pressure of outside circumstances. What was so clever about the original experiment is it showed a numerical imbalance, so the experimenter didn't have to have any idea which the most rational analysis was in any case. Could just show that since a person, lots of people repeat this, but always relative to themselves, there must be a bias in there. Now we make attributions, not always irrational all the time, but in this area we're in fact making three kinds of attribution about causes of events, causes of human actions, and but also the value or the consequences of an event to ourselves. So. So, in fact, it's not an accident that Seligman had a lot to do with cognitive behavioural therapy. It's about doing some work on your cognitive attributions. And the exercise, wrapped up for a self-help positive psychology market, is, first of all, something bad happens. That's the A for adversity. Secondly, you generalize to pessimistic beliefs about what's going to happen because of it, also the consequences, but what you then become active if you follow the exercise is the D, the disputation, is you argue with your original jumping to conclusions, you look for evidence that tends to counter the gloomy generalization, and the result is you feel energized rather than depressed and gloomy. So, have a little think, first privately and then with your neighbor. Do you think you tend to catastrophize? And do you have your own version of the technique? Because I think some people actually have their own ways of dealing with this. Didn't necessarily need Seligman to tell them what to do. Okay, well, Salimun clearly thinks everyone suffers from it. Is there anyone here who's fairly sure they're robustly defended against it and don't know what he's banging on about? Or are you all catastrophizers? Yep. No, I think if you see both, that's certainly the rational thing, and they balance each other. So do you feel well defended against jumping to the worst conclusion and sticking there? There you go. Someone who's so sane, she's prepared to announce it to the whole class. Anybody else sane? Or are you just all victims? Would any of you see yourselves as... Yes?
I'm kind of... If I'm in a good mood, I don't. When something goes wrong, I don't catastrophize. If I'm already in a
Right, so this would be good as a first aid kit, but you wouldn't need it all the time. I think I'm like you. I know when I'm tired and hungry in the evenings, I'll think bad things, even about good things. And I know enough to wait till the morning when I always feel a bit more able to be positive. Anyone else? Anyone else got particular, their own way of counteracting such unbalanced tendencies? I mentioned mine, really. Yeah. No, and I think that's an important answer because it's a social version which Seligman in this exercise is assuming a solo perspective, which is actually not a good assumption. Yeah. In fact, sorry, yeah? No, that's exactly Seligman's technique. So you do that already. Do you remember where you acquired that habit?
I think it was after reading some CBT material that it was interested in that, and I'm a little longer than the
classic series as well. Gee, look young to me. And that works for you, at least to some extent? Yes, I don't think I can do that at all. I mean, I wasn't aware of that till you said that. I mean, I almost started laughing at you because, but that made me realise that, I suppose, I tend to judge the value of the event as absolute, even if, yes, so waiting for the morning for me is more about when I'll be best able to think of how to counteract it rather than best to reevaluate its value in itself, which is what you're saying. It's rather impressive. I'll just go back for a moment, though, I think, to reinforce this, ask your mother or whatever. I think you can see this in quite a lot of parents, but with hindsight, I really think it strongly about my own mother, is that she managed to, her style was never to be dismissive about what we as children were thinking or feeling at the moment, but she would just project an alternative emotional way of looking at this event as if it just wasn't a catastrophe after all. She wasn't denying in a pushing away, just here's this other cognitive perspective you might have. And you can sometimes see parents do that, particularly with young children. You can, there's a certain age, I've occasionally glimpsed at this where, I don't know, a toddler, say, trips over and bangs himself on the floor, and there's a pause, probably because their breath is out and they can't yell, and then there's about half a second. And if the parent says something calm and distracting or alternative at that moment, then they don't burst into tears. And otherwise they don't. You can sort of clink. You can see their perspective being changed by their mother. Of course, adults are just so much more trouble, but still. Right. So, I've covered gratitude and remedies for catastrophization by way of introductory topics. I'm now going to try and set the scene for this course in various ways, beginning with some comments about the field of positive psychology, which harks back really to the opening question I asked you about what you thought happiness was. So first of all, it's actually very impressed me when I finally learned this, that in 1948, before even I was born, let alone you, the definition of health adopted and still current involved, I mean, it states that health is a state of complete physical, mental and social well-being, and not just the absence of, you know, some pathology. So that's a much more sophisticated view, really, than we hear in everyday discourse. And as I said briefly before, well-being, I think, is most often preferred here because we're often unaware of it. And I gather, third hand, is there anybody with some real philosophy courses behind them? Probably one or two of you hiding in here. Anyway, I have heard third hand that one of the things Heidegger said, his view of consciousness was really its function was to deal with problems. So he'd talk about how we'd operate, you know, for instance, the way I'm walking, until I decided to use that as an example. I wasn't thinking about my legs at all. We go through life actually not thinking about things until something goes wrong, until I trip slightly or doors locked in front of me. So Heidegger's view of what consciousness is mainly about is about problems. What rises to consciousness is a disruption of what you'd otherwise be doing without thinking about it. Now, that's an interesting way of looking at cognition, but the point here is that that would mean that asking people to introspect about their well-being is probably not a great place to get data, because we aren't necessarily aware of that. So, I said this at the beginning, I think. Joy seems to me to be about referring to a reaction to an event. Happiness is perhaps referring to a longer lasting state, but that word does seem to imply being conscious, whereas Heidegger's view would be that that's perhaps not where we want to be. So well-being is kind of a good word for implying what's actually good for you regardless of the degree to which you're aware of it. So maybe positive psychology could be thought of as being about being mentally healthy or possibly even super fit. Now, Seligman launched the phrase, and his argument was that Western psychology had spent the second half of the 20th century obsessing about mental illness, and that this was unbalanced because rather little was known about what characterized mental wellness. Obviously that isn't true of psychology as a whole. There are whole areas like perception that are nothing to do, well, almost nothing to do with pathology. But still, you see there's a point there even if it isn't about the whole of psychology. On the other hand, I think what I'd say now, in 2016, is that many positive psychology techniques have made major inroads into medical approaches. So I think there's a real connection with unwellness as well as wellness. It doesn't, on the other hand, that might not have come about without Seligman and others pushing to study the positive better. But I think the connection is there rather than it being a separation. So an intermediate position might be that we should be studying preventive mental preventive practices that are preventive of mental ill health, just as nutritionists and hygienists and so on study what practices are going to stop you being ill, suffer physical illness. And an early landmark, for those who like history at all, is the Brown and Harris study. That study that published in its own book was probably a landmark in mental health. What they did a study of clinical depression in working class women in Camberwell in South London, near where one of my sisters lives, and also the site of the Maudsley Hospital, but that's not really relevant. What they did is they actually managed to do what I'd have thought, I would have guessed in advance wouldn't be possible, is to find a way of collecting many women's experiences and comparing them. That's the difficult bit. Now, they not only found the most common precipitating causes, for instance, losing your husband, and some things which didn't fit with common sense at the time but are clearly true, which is that losing your house is as likely to make you is as severe a trauma as losing your husband. Not only were able to say things about the most common precipitating causes, but were also able to identify what they call vulnerability factors. That is, what preventative factors stop some women with equally strong traumas from getting depressed but aren't present in other women who do get depressed. Things like whether you've got supportive relatives living in the same street or not, things like that. So that, I mention it here because that idea of what they call vulnerability factors or their obverse preventative factors would be clearly worth knowing about, and there's an analogy between physical and mental health and ill health in that respect. Now, here's a little twist. So Seligman tended to present positive psychology as, to present it as if mental illness is to do with, treating mental illness is to get people from a negative state of mental health up to zero. Positive psychology is about getting above zero. That was a simple idea. If, however, I extrapolate Leah Palmer's work and think about whether society's changed for the worse in this respect, if religion, in fact, were spirituality, say, is a preventive factor, and we've, as it were, had a sudden drought of its protective factors, maybe we should think of a three-part regime. one from minus to zero, one from zero cranking up to where we would have been, say, 300 years ago in Britain, and then positive above that. Now, that's just a speculation, but if Leah's right that some positive psychology interventions that show an effect on most people don't show effect on spirituality, we might want to think about a sort of three-zone kind of landscape. Now, I'm just going to mention this. It's become evident in the last few years that there's an area which hasn't got an agreed name. I'm going to call it mHealth. I'll just say a bit about it. And I'm saying a bit about it because I've had one or two students move on to jobs in this area. I think there are going to be more and more jobs in this area. If your later career turns out to be in any way connected with positive psychology, it might turn out to be in this area. The trouble is, there's no university department of this. It's not quite recognised as an area. That means you'll never see job ads where you expect them, but that doesn't mean they won't come up if you know what you're looking for. Okay, so why am I saying mHealth when nobody else does well? The M could stand for mental, could stand for mobile, because nowadays a lot of the interventions are delivered over the internet in one way or another, or it could refer to mass, as in a mass population rollout. Why is rollout important? Well, as you probably know, there's essentially a massive mental health epidemic if you look at the number of referrals now compared to 30, 40 years ago. That demand is never, ever going to be satisfied by one-to-one treatment. Being a clinical psychologist is about as useful as, I don't know, equipping a flood responder with a finger to put in a dike. The numbers are never going to be tackled in that way. And so there's two things. One is, can we do mass programs of self-help for those who are already needing help? But the other, probably better in the long term, is to take a public health approach. And that's because if you look at what saved millions of lives from physical disease, it isn't actually hospitals and doctors. Those are people we cling to when we're suffering ourselves. But the big lifesavers aren't done by doctors. They're done by clean water supplies, by vaccination programs. So the question here is, can we identify these preventive factors? Can we get the population to adopt them widely? That's much more likely to address the epidemic in an effective way. Because what gets headlines in academia as well as in public, of course, is heroic last-ditch remediation. I'll just mention one other thing about that. I don't know if any of you bothered to read up some of the details about the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, but I think one of the interesting things hiding there, if you read a bit further, is how they brought the epidemic to an end, as you're probably aware, and absolutely nothing, no actions were to do with curing patients. We don't have a cure for Ebola. It was done by methods that could have been applied 1,000 years ago, but actually are much more likely to be applied in today's society. It was about civil servants, not doctors, what they did. So it's all about tracing the contacts of... Well, first of all, you put diagnosed patients in an isolation ward. You then keep them there and about half die, and you bury them with precautions so they don't infect other people. The other half get better, and when you're sure they're not infectious anymore, you send them back home. But you have to trace their contacts. So it's all about tracing contacts, having camps for them to go to, sitting out the disease, putting up with something that's hugely distressing to medics, is not being able to do anything for these patients who are dying horribly and asking you for help and you can't do anything at all. But nevertheless, that was how they ended the epidemic. So it's just a a reminder that all the glamour of high-tech bioscience actually contributed nothing. The real cure was not done by doctors, it was done by social organisation. So, could this apply to mental health? Well, I'll make sure you've got access to this reference by Knox et al. Some years ago, I had a psychiatrist as a neighbour in my tenement. He put me onto this. It's a very, if you don't know anything about it, it's such an impressive paper in the BMJ. What this was about was the American Air Force, and it must have been someone right at the top, decided, and I don't know why they decided because it didn't mention it in the medical journal, but they decided there was too many suicides and they were going to do something about it in the American Air Force. And they applied, over 18 months, they applied a set of education methods, really, and they reduced the suicide rate in the Air Force, which I don't think has in any way a radically high suicide rate, it's just preventable deaths, reduced it by a third. That's so impressive. This wasn't done by doctors and psychiatrists, it was done by things like encouraging people to recognize dangerous symptoms in their subordinates, recognize them in their peers, and so on and so forth. So for me, that establishes that a public health preventive approach to mental health actually can pay off, and pay off big. So that sort of, in general terms, is why I think I'm not being over-optimistic to think that what I'm loosely calling mHealth might be important. Okay, I'm going to proceed now, but I've got a link up already. I've got a very sloppy web page I put up for my own use, but if you're interested, it's basically a list of contacts about people at Glasgow University who are in some way associated with this mHealth area. And it's a diverse community, because there's computer scientists who think this is a great opportunity for new gadgets. There's medical health people who are interested in it, and so on. So, okay, so back to the nature of positive psychology as an intellectual field. So I suppose I see mHealth as perhaps the socially most important possible application of psychology, that is, a big scale, some potential for big population size effects. Okay, back to the nature of it as a study area. It attracts hobbyists and self-help. It attracts mad claims. However, there's some well-designed experimental work. In other words, from your point of view as an honor student, it's absolutely brilliant piece of psychology because you have to apply critical thinking. You can find examples of absolutely disgraceful stuff. You can find examples of very respectable stuff, and it's important to discriminate between the two. There's also different views, both of which have an element of reason about them, about, well, is this completely different, or is it nothing new at all, doesn't deserve a name even, or what's the attitude you're going to take towards this? Each topic generally has connections to old practices, to existing fields, to exercises which might be interventions that professionals organise, or they might be self-help hobbyist ones, and so on and so forth. So there are lots of different angles, and what I'd really hope as a sort of learning aim of the course is that you do some exercise on seeing these multiple perspectives, so that each time you get a new bit of positive psychology, you think about these links, how it applies to the latest thing you've done, latest thing you've read in positive psychology. I've got those textbooks up on a web page, in fact. Just a moment. I should have had this up on my opening slide. That's the URL of the main course page. It points to the Moodle, and the Moodle will point back to it. But when I mention things I've got up on the web, they're probably hanging off that page if you look at it. So you might just want to jot that down. So there are some textbooks. That's not necessarily a very up-to-date list, but if you wanted to browse, they should be in the library. This course certainly isn't primarily organized around a textbook, but the thing about the positive psychology textbook is it will give you a bunch of different things to look at if you want some idea of the scope. I'm not saying you need to focus on breadth, but you might want a place to look. And they're all a bit different, especially these early textbooks. So, in fact, I was inspired to even look into positive psychology because of that guy at the top, Ben Shahar, who put on an undergraduate course at Harvard on this, which has had the biggest enrollment, apparently, of any course that Harvard's ever had. And it was a hugely long course, and every week there'd be a different personal intervention, some of which he designed himself. So, and Seligman's got quite a few things themselves. So if you're looking for exercises from a do-it-yourself point of view, which is definitely one angle, they're probably a bit more likely to be found in a textbook than they are in a paper. Now, unlike I think all the other option courses in psychology, this isn't primarily my area of research and my hobby horse. I put it on because I thought quite a lot of students would be interested in doing it, and it was clear none of my colleagues would do it any time this century. So I put it on hoping it would serve some sort of student interest. Now, a consequence of that, though, is that I'm by no means an expert, super expert at this. A lot of the option courses, you have the pleasure of hearing someone who really knows that stuff and is updating their knowledge every week. That's not the kind of service I'm providing for you. On the other hand, the trouble, although it's very nice in some ways to attend a course where it's clear the person giving it is completely in love with their subject, it's also true that if my other course is the subject I deeply engaged in. And the trouble with that, the irony of that really, is it's about education techniques. And one of the most obvious things in education is the best learning doesn't come from banging on and on and on and on and on, and on, and on about students, never giving them a moment to think for themselves. That's actually bad teaching, although it can be engaging because enthusiasm keeps our attention. So the advantage of this is I'm actually able to urge you to learn for yourself, and able to shut myself up in a way I have much more trouble doing on a hobby horse of mine. It's therefore the particular way I'm doing that is organizing this course very heavily around the coursework, where in your coursework you'll be in teams of approximately three. There'll be some twos and fours, and the aim is to produce a briefing for other people in the class about a particular topic different from everyone else's topic in positive psychology. And that, getting students to generate content for each other, has proved educationally very effective, and this is an appropriate place for me to try and do this. I mean, it's effective in several ways, but one of the ways it's effective is probably the single most powerful learning technique any of you could do is to try and teach someone else. In fact, if you're revising another subject, trying to teach someone who hasn't done the revision yet may not help them all that much, but it will help you enormously. It's only when you're teaching the 100th person that you're no longer learning very much, but the first time, it's so educational. It's the most powerful thing you can do. And that's replicated over and over and over again in the literature. I mean, peer-assisted learning schemes are quite good for the clients, but they're it's completely unambiguous how good they are for the facilitator students. Okay, so the main coursework is for you to create, well, I say a web page. Actually, with this year's technology, I think it'll be best if you produce a Word document and publish it on a web page within the course Moodle. I'll give you details of that in a moment. So I just want to reinforce why the way in which this course is different and why I'm doing what I'm doing and not doing what you might be expecting. Right, so the real brief of the web page is not to reproduce opinions that I have, it's not to produce a first-class piece of knowledge that no one else has, it's to be useful. Now, that doesn't mean that you're going to be vulnerable to whether your peers produce facts that you rely on. Because actually, and this is true of me as an academic, but I expect you begin to recognize this, the way in which other people are really useful to you in some area like this is to alert you to topics you might have missed, to say just enough about them that you can judge whether, well, they're keen on that, but I wouldn't be, or on the contrary, that's just the sort of thing I want to follow up. And if you are interested enough, to give you the pointers to where you should start. Because those are the things which an outsider doesn't know and which save so much time in focusing in. So it isn't really about whether it's highly accurate what other students offer you. It's whether they offer you enough so you can make a judgment about whether that's one of the areas you're going to go for. And if so, how can you get started without spending days leafing through 1,000 abstracts, only one of which turns out to have what you would be best off knowing. I've changed research field more than once in my life, and I realised thinking about it, that's what's so useful about being in the university and talking to colleagues. It's not their publications, which of course I might read in their area, it's the informal opinions they give that are so helpful. You know, they say, this is really interesting, but no one's ever going to believe it, or alternatively, not many people believe this, but this is really right. It's that inside knowledge which you can't publish in a journal, but which insiders know, that's what's so helpful. Telling you what not to bother your head about versus what to pay attention, even though it doesn't seem particularly obvious that that's what you should focus on. So there's probably going to be somewhere between 19 and 26 topics you produce as a class. For the exam, if you're a pretty bad student, you'll only study one, the one you wrote. If you're a rather good student, you might study six of them in depth. So you'll leaf through the other 20 and pick the six that one way or another you think are most interested in. So the main point of these web pages is to equip people to make that choice rapidly and to follow up the choice to get off to a fast start in investigating an area for themselves and checking what you said about it. Now, the other aspect of this is is exercising you in a writing style you'll have probably, unless any of you are a journalist, you've probably never ever had been asked to do before. So, as you know, if you're writing a thriller, a whodunit, where it's all about concealing the answer to the end, you expect the reader to read it from beginning to the end. Of course, some bad people try and flip to the end, but it's that's not what the author's expecting. Similarly, unfortunately, academics often write the same way. They think, I've got it into a journal, and everyone will read it all. Almost everywhere else in life, life ain't like that. It's become a bit more acute on the web, where there's some frightening statistic, probably out of date now, about commercial sites and how many users that visit a company's website, if they haven't found what they think is what they want in about 2.5 mouse clicks, they won't go back for at least 6 months. So people are unbelievably impatient on the web, but they're not much better elsewhere, because if you think about a newspaper, what really happens, because you know few people read a newspaper and no one reads them from start to end in that order. So the headline of an article has to attract a reader. So it's no good having a witty headline that you only know why it's witty after you read the whole article. Because if the headline doesn't attract them, it doesn't matter how good the rest of your writing is. If the first line of the first paragraph doesn't seem interesting, you won't even read the rest of the first paragraph. If the first paragraph doesn't seem interesting, you won't read the rest. So a lot of editors will tell a journalist that they have to, in some sense, have the whole story in the first paragraph. It's no good having an unexpected vital piece of information at the end, like you would in a detective story, where surprise is virtue. In other words, it's pyramid writing. Now, what I only learned late in life, and still probably don't have the skill all that much, is that this applies, say, to grant applications, fundamental to the success of an academic career, because grant applications are refereed by impatient other academics, and if the title of the grant seems boring, the referees will say they've read it, but they probably haven't. And similarly with the first paragraph, I'd better have all the bits that are really important in it, not wait to a logical place. In other words, I think this is likely to be true of writing you do in most careers, is it has to be of that pyramid nature, where people have to be motivated from the start. So this is your chance to try and acquire that skill. These are only suggestions. This will be on a handout, may even be on a handout you have. So I've given a little scaffolding. You don't have to stick to that, but it's about the kind of things that would interest your peers, and won't be like, if you just go into essay writing mode, it'll look like a good essay, but it won't really be useful to your peers. So it's always tempting to be witty in a title, but unless you think people are only going to read your thing because it's amusing and a break from positive psychology, actually the title better say what the topic's about. You probably want early on a few key experimental results summarized, and maybe the best single starter thing, because people have to make a judgment whether they're interested in this area. And the best possible place to start, that's probably a lot to do with that. These are other things that are interested. So, got a little guidance, but it's a new mode of writing, and one you'll probably find useful in future life. You can also, if I'm not being over-optimistic, say that this is likely to boost your graduate attributes, your generic employability attributes. You'll be creating something to post on the web, you'll be writing in this new format, you'll be working in a team you didn't know and didn't choose, at least you probably will. This is a timetable. Now, I'm going to spend significant amounts of time in each session getting this moving, because we only have 5 meetings, and this is coming towards the end of the first meeting, and things have to be moved forward promptly. So the first thing I want you to do, but I haven't, that you're just about ready to go with, is to do a bit of work between now and next week looking at some of the past year's offerings. And what I want you to do is to produce some critiques. I want you to develop as a consumer points about past offerings that you think are good or bad, about the structure most of all, about how they put the stuff across, what works for you and what doesn't, because I want you to have that experience as a consumer of this kind of web page, and to develop taste about what is particularly good and bad. So I hope you'll have produced critiques of past topics by next time. There's on the course webpage, there's a little pro forma you can use to jot down some. There are some criticisms of at least a few of them, and there are links to past years, so you can go exploring. If when I get back to this tomorrow morning I find the links aren't all in order, I may fix them and then email the class to say I fixed them. But don't hesitate to email if you can't get at something you should be able to get at. Because I hope you'll be able to get into past Moodle pages as a guest. That is, you won't be able to delete anything, but you should be able to read it. So that's one.